Hello, I'm Ernie Manoos. Welcome to Next Question. Jay Leno loves to tell jokes. He also loves collecting cars and motorcycles. And since he was just here in Houston, we thought we'd ring him up and find out how these passions came to be. So we'll catch up with him a little later in the show to find out. Someone else who also loves a good joke, also a thoughtful conversation, and is a great interviewer is Craig Cohen, host of Houston Matters with Craig Cohen. He'll join us shortly to tell us about his most recent interview subject, the most difficult one of his career. Plus, critics are starting to put out their best lists for 2019. Our own Dustin Chase will be here to share a couple of those and give us his views on two new films, Aeronauts and The Two Popes. And Troy Schultz joins us at the end of the show to share some music from the series Skyline Sessions. But first, joining me now in studio is Jen Rice, our City Hall reporter for News 88.7. Hello there.
Hey.
Okay, so you've been following what's going on over in City Council District B race. A couple weeks back, we had an election. Because we're in the city of Houston, it's nonpartisan. So if somebody doesn't get 50% of the vote, there's a runoff. A lot of races have runoff. Council B is unique. They get a runoff, but there's a question about one of the top two candidates.
Correct.
That's caught a lot of attention. You did a story on it that aired last week. Let's give that story a listen.
A contested Houston City Council race won't be on the December 14th runoff ballot because of a lawsuit that argues a candidate with a felony isn't eligible to run. When Cynthia Bailey made the runoff for the District B race, no one was more surprised than she was.
So I went to bed in third, but when I woke up, I was in second. I said, oh, Lord, I got so excited. And I knew then that, hey, these people really care and they really know the work that I do, that it speaks for itself.
Bailey runs a nonprofit for local kids, and she spent the last 2 years cleaning up the district, picking up debris from illegal dumping. More than a decade ago, Bailey was convicted of theft. Now she wants to represent District B, which includes majority African-American neighborhoods like Cashmere Gardens and Acres Homes.
You know, I just ask, God, you sure this for me? You sure this for me? And I keep asking. And the next thing I know, I was in a runoff.
But Bailey won't be on the ballot in December because the third place candidate is suing the city and county, arguing that Bailey's felony conviction disqualifies her under state law.
It makes me feel bad because you're telling me that you can do good as long as you don't get on my level. No, we all should be at a certain level in life after we paid our debt to society. We did the time. We did everything you asked of me. And so now I can never come up to the top step. I always have to be in the middle of the step. And I don't think that's right.
She hopes her campaign sends a message to other people in her shoes that they're qualified to run. Mary Moreno with the Texas Organizing Project agrees with her.
If you can vote, you can run. Your rights have been restored, you can run.
Many residents are upset that the race won't be on the ballot, and Moreno says the question of Bailey's eligibility means a lot to people in the district and across the state of Texas.
If you have money, a lot of times you can get a lesser penalty, a lesser conviction, but if you're poor, and then it's easier to get a felony conviction. So we can't keep punishing people for that. If we are saying that you've paid your debt to society, then we should allow people to live full lives. And that includes running for office.
Last week, there was an unusual rally about all this. At the front of the crowd, the two candidates, Cynthia Bailey and Tarsha Jackson, stood united side by side. They were surrounded by people demanding the right to vote at the same time as everyone else. Angela Johnson, who lives in District B, was at the rally.
It makes me feel good because I see two African-American women up there that are not fighting and tearing each other down, but are holding hands and saying, I got you, my sister.
Johnson says she believes Cynthia Bailey deserves a second chance.
Either way it go, those two together are speaking up about things that are going on in our community.
The front runner in the race, Tarsha Jackson, worries voters won't make it to the polls when a special election is called sometime next year.
The city attorney could have said, hey, no, you know, we're going to run our race. We'll deal with this later. So they had that power. I'm really disappointed in the city attorney for, you know, allowing the county to pull District B off the ballot.
That's why Jackson was at the rally, because while Texas law may be unclear, she's unequivocal in her support of her opponent Cynthia Bailey's right to run.
So it just says a lot about the moment that we're in right now in criminal justice reform, that we really need to start looking broadly, not just at bail reform, but at true second chances, whether it's jobs, housing, that our district, which is majority Black and brown, they're suffering from being disproportionately impacted by a criminal justice system, and so that we need to pay attention to it all.
Okay, a lot to unpack there. Mm-hmm. So take me back a little bit. What actually happened to Cynthia Bailey? Why was she convicted? Do we know?
What I know is it was 10 years ago. It was theft. It's above $200,000. So that's sort of the category of the crime, above $200,000 theft. She was sentenced. She served her time. And she says that she's eligible to take her seat on city council.
So this doesn't seem as easy as it seems at first, mm-hmm. because in, I think, our collective wisdom, our collective knowledge of how government works, if you're a convicted felon, you can't run for office. Not necessarily true.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of misconceptions here. Like, yeah. A lot of people might think that actually that former felons can't vote in Texas, which they can and they have been able to since 1997. You know, I think there's just a lot of misunderstandings about this type, this part of the law. But actually, with this case, it really is confusing. Like, it's not just that people aren't sure. It's like the law isn't sure. I mean, It's really quite ambiguous.
Which is what I like about your story. In the beginning, we hear this surface and we think, well, that's shut, open and shut case. No question here. But the more you're digging, the more you find, no, it's not. It's
yeah.
the way the law is written. It's
yeah.
the intent of the law. It's
yeah.
what does it really mean?
And this isn't a common scenario. There aren't typically, you know, there aren't typically races that get pulled off the ballot at the last minute. This isn't something where someone's like, oh, let's call, you know, the city that recently had this happen. Like,
right.
this
There's nobody else to look
yeah,
to.
This doesn't really happen often. So this isn't something that everyone knows what to do with. So right now, one issue that's been going on is there's this tension between the county and the city. It's a city election, but the county is responsible for administering the election. So they're sort of just like in a managerial role. They take care of, you know, the operations of the election. And so there's some pointing fingers. People in District B are really upset. They feel that they're being disenfranchised. So, you know, they're being asked to go to the polls again and again.
And to clarify, it's because their race has been taken off the ballot.
Yeah.
They cannot vote in the runoff for
yeah.
District B.
Yeah.
They're going to have a special election for mm-hmm. that once they figure out what to do.
Yeah.
Here.
So, you know, early voting is going on right now for this election, which will be in a week. And they're going to so District B residents will go to the polls like everybody else right now. They're going to elect a mayor. They're going to elect 5 at-large city council seats, but they can't vote for their district rep. And so they're really upset about it.
And the reason it's off the ballot is because the third place finisher sued. Mm-hmm. Because the third place finisher feels that if Cynthia Bailey wasn't on the ticket, she would be on the ticket and she would be in the runoff.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really kind of interesting there, because now let's go into the law of it, because you've been digging in to see mm-hmm. how does this even begin? What happened here? Because some people will also argue that Bailey should never have been on the ballot to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
What's the law?
Yeah, so I've been doing a ton of digging in this area. I'm just really fascinated by it. You know, I'm like a policy dweeb, and I know you are too.
Me too. Yeah,
we're both
in the weeds here, folks.
Yeah, this is like Ernie and Jen's nerd hour.
I promise it won't go on for an hour, but
yeah.
it could.
So the key line of the law is you cannot run for office if you're a former felon unless 2 conditions have been met. Either you've been pardoned or you've been released from the resulting disabilities. So release from the resulting disabilities is the weird line that people aren't sure what
so
it means.
Pardon means the governor said,
yeah.
okay, forget about this. It never happened. It's
yeah.
expunged. There's nothing on your...
You're all clear.
But that second part,
yeah.
otherwise released from the resulting disabilities.
Yeah. And so I went back and I've been trying to figure out, like, who wrote this and can I call him or her? I've been working with, you know, like some of the legislative agencies. And I did find that in 1975, the election code said something different.
What did it say back then? Do you have it?
Yeah. It says, unless the same 2 conditions, pardoned or had his full rights of citizenship restored by other official action. So in 1985, the state did a big overhaul of the election code. They said, oh, things have gotten really hairy and we've been changing things bit by bit. We're going to do a big overhaul and recodify the election code in 1985. And that's when they took whatever was there, the thing I just read to you, and they changed it. So yeah, I've been kind of...
So what did they mean by that before? Was it basically if you had served your time, Does that clear you? Because a pardon is different than that. Mm-hmm. So it almost reads, being the non-lawyer that mm-hmm. I am, that it's got to be something beyond just serving your time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to me it sounds like they want a court. They want a judge to have released you from something.
Okay.
So they want an official court action.
The rewrite mm-hmm. became otherwise released from the resulting disabilities. Mm-hmm. Meaning what?
It's unclear. And so in the last legislative session, there was a state senator who filed a bill saying, let's just cut out the second part. So he wants it to be only one condition. You either
so you
be
have
pardoned,
pardoned or nothing.
Or nothing.
But that didn't pass, correct?
Didn't pass.
What is the conventional wisdom of what that means?
I don't think there is a conventional wisdom about it. Ken Paxton, the state attorney general, weighed in on it over the last year. I think it was in May, saying that former felons are not eligible. So that's the state attorney general weighing in. But that's an opinion. It's not the law.
Right.
I mean, it's his interpretation of the law. And then Cynthia Bailey, who's the person, you know, at the center of this whole thing, she's saying the way she interprets it is when her voting rights were restored, so was her eligibility to run for office. And that is how it works in 23 other states.
Okay. So if you're a convicted felon, mm-hmm. and you served your time. Mm-hmm. If I'm reading this right, the resulting disability that we're assuming it means from Cynthia's point of view is that you can't vote. But if that is restored upon you, then that disability is now gone.
That's what she says.
That's what she says. Mm-hmm. People had to vote for this language.
Mm-hmm.
State House had to vote for this language. The people that voted or the person who wrote it, have you been able to track them down and find out what their understanding of it is? Because it's really weird language.
It is
in
weird.
The sense that if somebody wrote it, they had to explain to people what it meant.
Totally.
And people to vote on
these
it
things
had
don't
to
come
understand.
Out of, they don't come out of nowhere.
Right.
Yeah. And this was in 1985 and they were trying to clarify something. You know, they were like, oh, the election code isn't clear, so we're going to make it clearer.
Yeah.
And it may not be clearer.
Legalese can get really murky.
Yeah. So the other,
because it's so murky, it can be interpreted multiple ways mm-hmm. to serve the purpose of the legislators.
Yeah. The author of the Senate bill that was rewriting the election code is Chet Edwards, and he was really young at the time. So, you know, I was thinking like, oh no, like if this was 30 years ago, like this person might be dead by now. But no, he's really young.
He was a young legislator.
Yeah,
he's still thriving today.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's always nice to have
like a
super.
Are you hunting him down or have you found him?
Yeah. I've reached out. It's Chet Edwards. He was also a longtime Waco congressman mm-hmm. until 2011 when that seat flipped. He's a Democrat. And yeah, I'm still trying to reach out to him. Chet, if you're listening, I shouldn't call him that. I should be like Congressperson Edwards.
Yes. Please, please let us know what you meant by that. How does this get resolved in the short term?
So I actually talked to the mayor yesterday about this, and, you know, he says he's still hoping that the race will be on the January 28th ballot. And that's there are some state House seats that are up for election that are also having a runoff. And Governor Abbott is actually in charge of scheduling that, and he has scheduled it for January 28th. So people will be going to the polls then anyway.
Who decides when this gets on the ballot, and who decides whether or not Cynthia Bailey can actually be on the ballot? Who's making that decision?
Well, so the law says that you can't hold a runoff election until the judgment in the contest becomes final. So this has to be resolved in court before they can put it on the ballot, and then they're going to probably schedule it as soon as possible after that. But it could be January, it could be February, it could be March.
So where does the election board sit on this? Where does our election judge sit on it? Because, I don't know if technically, because we don't know what the law actually means, but the concern is it shouldn't have gotten to this point in the first place. Shouldn't this have been decided months ago?
Yeah, I think one of the things that, as someone who's been watching it really closely, what it looks like to me that's really interesting is there's a lot of the city being like, well, the county, and the county being like, well, the city, and then everyone being like, well, the state. And there's a lot of shifting on this. Nobody really wants to handle it. Cynthia Bailey's attorney told me he calls it a hot potato, a political hot potato. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people just don't really want to deal with this. They don't want full responsibility for it, maybe. You know, the mayor says that he actually does agree with the county, the way they've been handling it. That their decision to remove it from the ballot, which was controversial.
Another point in this whole story, which I think actually is different than the way we see a lot of politics today, is that actually Tarsha Jackson was standing up with Cynthia Bailey. At least they agree on this.
They do. They do. Yeah. And it was really astonishing and very fascinating to go to the event that they had outside of City Hall. They had this press conference and to see them all together. It was Jerry Davis, the incumbent, who's the current city council member. Mm-hmm. And he's like off to the side chatting with both of the candidates. And it's like a real sense of unity there.
Right. But then you can always wonder, what does that really mean? What is really at play here? We've got the third place candidate who says this should not be happening to begin with.
Right.
So why are these two coming together? Does that mean one thinks they have a better?
Right.
There's so much that goes on. I don't know how you keep it all straight.
There are a lot of questions, but it's a really fascinating race.
Well, I think if anyone is going to get to the bottom of it, it's going to be Jen Rice, who follows City Hall all the time here at News 88.7. Thank you so much for helping us with this. And when it gets resolved, come back and let us know what it all meant.
I will be here.
Thanks, Jen.
Thank you.
Now, each week, we look for a story that's generated a lot of listener response and then invite Gail DeLauder, our afternoon NPR anchor, in to share those comments with us here in our HPM inbox. Today, we've got two stories, but we still only have one Gail. Hello, Gail.
Hey, Ernie.
So you got a couple stories for us today.
Well, sure, Ernie. One story we've been watching pretty closely in the newsroom has to do with the Port Neches voluntary evacuation. There was another one just recently, and that's because of butadiene. That's the chemical that the plant manufactures. It remains detectable, so as long as that's in the air, they really can't get in to do any investigation. Jefferson County Emergency Management says the elevated levels do not pose a serious health risk, but could cause all kinds of illnesses, things like dizziness, nausea, headaches, or irritation. The powerful explosions happened November 27th. That was at the TPC Group plant in Port Neches. That's near Beaumont and about 80 miles east of Houston.
I'm assuming a story like that's going to get some response.
Well, we heard from Marcia Drummond. She said these, quote, assurances do not make me feel comfortable. Frowny face. We also heard from Anjali Gupta Mehta, who said, trust us. Not a health risk. Karen Lal Stevens responded, praying for everyone affected. Margie Elliott tells us, define, quote, serious.
I think some of those are a little tongue-in-cheek there.
It's all in the reading, yes.
Another story going on, which is really kind of a very interesting story as far as help goes in our community.
Well, you know, Ernie, one thing we talk about all the time is food insecurity here in the Houston region, and we're learning that about 700,000 SNAP recipients could lose benefits under a new Trump administration rule.
And that's 700,000 nationwide.
Right, around the country, and the administration has finalized a rule to limit food stamp benefits for single able-bodied adults who can't show that they work more than 20 hours a week. The administration says the change is intended to encourage those recipients to get jobs. But anti-hunger advocates worry it'll hurt low-income people who can't find steady work.
Mm-hmm.
Patricia Diaz tells us part of the problem is it's hard to regulate situations based on numbers or preconceived notions of who these services go to.
Mm-hmm.
Encouraging people to receive SNAP benefits to get jobs. Talk about out of touch with what it's like to live in the underserviced. Also, Oscar G. Savalero responded, and he said they won't be low income after they get a job. Robin Black replied promptly saying, yes, but sometimes you can only find a job that makes less than a living wage. I know it will cost money, but it needs to be regulated better. And what about senior citizens? Oscar quickly responded, it only affects 700,000. I read a more thorough article, and elder, disabled, and parents with children would not be directly affected. States or regions with over 6% unemployment could also be exempt. And then Carol Unsicker weighed in, saying money managing courses are needed.
Good advice, thoughtful exploration of the topic. And Gail, thank you.
Thank you, Ernie.
So remember, we're always interested in your thoughts and opinions. You can leave comments about HPM stories either on our website at HoustonPublicMedia.org or on our Facebook page, Houston Public Media, or through social media. Or you can also email us at nextquestion@HoustonPublicMedia.org or hashtag NextQHOU. Still to come on today's show, Craig Cohen interviews his most challenging subject. We'll talk car collecting with Jay Leno and the music of Morgan James as Next Question continues. I'm Ernie Manous, and this is Next Question. Each week, we like to chat with the folks around our own station to see what they've got going on. And a lot of you are familiar with Craig Cohen, who hosts Houston Matters with Craig Cohen every day at 9 a.m., repeats at 7 p.m., and also always available as a podcast. Well, Craig is known for his interviewing skills and prowess, and it turns out he had the hardest subject of his career recently. Craig Cohen joins me now. Hello, Craig.
Hi, Ernie. How are you?
Okay, we're going to talk about a whole bunch of stuff, but I have to start with, you got to interview someone you don't usually get to interview, but you probably talk to a lot.
Yeah. The University of Houston has a magazine, UH Magazine. They reached out to me a few months back and said, we really want to do a profile of you. And the thought occurred to us that the best person that could possibly interview you is you. And so I interviewed myself, and that just came out in the last week or so in the University of Houston magazine.
Okay, now we're both interviewers, yep. So we think about these things differently than probably the everyday person does. But did you worry about giving yourself the questions ahead of time? Did you think, do I want to ask this or that, thinking of what? Did you approach it like you would a regular interview?
I did not. What I did was just stream of consciousness type away. And just, it started with my left brain and right brain saying to one another, this is weird, isn't it? Yes, it is. And just see where the conversation spilled from there.
Okay, I've got to ask. So did you learn anything about your subject by interviewing him?
I learned that I talk too much, but I think I already knew that, actually.
Oh, I'm terrible. I'm terrible at being interviewed. I'd much prefer asking the questions. When I'm interviewed, I never know when to stop talking.
For me, it's that it's just much easier to ask questions than it is to answer them.
Oh, I wonder if it is. I'll ponder that. I'll ask myself that and write about it sometime. So what did you write about?
Oh, you mean for this particular interview?
Well,
what they wanted to know was a little bit more about Houston Matters and what we do on the program. And so I sort of took myself through that, and then started to find myself veering off course, talking a little bit about why we don't have an NHL team here in Houston.
Of course,
pulling myself back from the brink, getting back on track. And honestly, it's worth checking out. It's online now.
We'll put a link on our website. Yeah. I'm fascinated. Did you enjoy the process?
I did. It's kind of fun. It's I've done a little bit, just a little bit of sketch comedy writing over the years, and it kind of felt a little bit like that.
Yeah. Well, the bigger point of this whole conversation is the fact that you like to interview people, and I do too. And the two of us have built our careers on interviewing. When are you going to slip in and fill in on Next Question for me?
I'm happy to do it anytime.
Oh, cool. I'd love to hear Next Question with Ernie Manous with Craig Cohen, as opposed to Houston Matters with Craig Cohen with Ernie Manous.
This is just so exhausting to listen to.
Did you always want to interview people?
I guess I've always been naturally curious and find lots of different subjects interesting, and I find passionate people interesting.
Yeah.
What has always stuck out to me is, and this maybe applies to one of the questions that I asked myself for that article, which is what makes a good guest. One of the things that makes a good guest is somebody that is really passionate about what it is they do, think about, whatever expertise they're bringing to the table. I don't know about you, but one of my favorite moments in any conversation, in just everyday life, is when somebody walks through the door and says, you won't believe what happened to me. And they proceed to tell some anecdote.
Yeah.
And there's passion and there's excitement and there's storytelling. I love hearing people tell stories. And that's maybe the piece of interviewing that I think I enjoy the most.
For me, what you said at the very beginning hits very true. It's a natural curiosity. You have to be naturally curious, I think, to be a good interviewer. You have to want to know more than what you've just been told. And it's kind of why I enjoy doing this show is that I have the opportunity to go beyond what the story is and sit with the reporter and say, yeah, but. And I always want to know that yes, but part. And your natural curiosity comes out in your interviews. And that's what I think is so engaging about them. It takes us a little bit further along. You were asked to put together to speak to some group about how to be a good interviewer. What were some of the things you discovered?
I came up with a sort of top 10 list for, and I've shared this with a few different groups over the years, of things that we do in advance of Houston Matters or during Houston Matters that hopefully make the interviews we do on the show effective. And as I throw out some of these, I should point out, I don't claim to be perfect at this. I make a lot of mistakes. And in fact, one of the tips that I had was to avoid some of the following things. And then I listed off, I realized I could list off a whole bunch of things that I do wrong from time to time. But among the things that I tried to share were things like doing research, a lot of research ahead of time, having a team of people that can work on it and trusting that team. That's really important. Trusting, but verifying statistics that maybe a resource shares with you or a guest plans to talk about. Make sure that we've looked that up and we can verify, yes, that actually is the right number, or we avoid sharing the number.
I'm going to jump in with on you as you're going along because I'll never remember all the points to the end. But I want to say, when it comes to research for me, I need to do it myself.
Oh,
I have a very hard time because like we said about natural curiosity, I read something and I want to know more about why. So I want to know the source and I want to find it along the way. And so I've had other people prepare what I call one sheets or stuff for me. And it just always, it doesn't work for me.
It works for me in terms of that's a starting point.
It's a starting point.
It's here is the basic thrust of the story of the conversation that we think we want to tell. And then it's a question of digging in from there. Oh, this person has this particular anecdote about thus and such, or they did this in their background. Okay, those are some things we can talk about. But I wonder why they went to that place, or I wonder why they tell that story. And then you start to dig in a little bit deeper.
It may be that I'm a control freak. And so I catch up. The other thing you said that I think a lot of people don't realize, they talk about research, research, research. I almost never have prepared questions. And I think people misinterpret that as having not researched or prepared for the interview, where for me, it's the total opposite. I need to look this person up, study them, understand them, and then leave all that at the door.
Okay. So something, you and I have that last part in common, but in terms of questions, I do the opposite. I have prepared questions, but my belief is that you need to be so prepared that you can then throw it all away. That without the preparation, without having that ready to roll, it makes it a lot harder to listen to what the person is saying and react and adjust the conversation as we go.
For me,
that preparation is so critical.
I have also a different luxury that you really don't have. And for the majority of the things I have done in this career, I've chosen my guests. And there's a difference when you're picking who you want because you want to talk to them, as opposed to I've got an hour to film every single day and there's a bunch of different things that have to get hit on. And other people are saying you got to talk to this person and this person and that person. And I think it takes an added level of skill to be able to make them all sound the same from your point of view, that the interest level all feels the same from you. And I admire that.
Well, thank you for that. But I am still interested in them and whoever it is that we have on the show. And really, that is the group effort. That's what the Houston Matters team does in the background. We identify potential topics and then we start to work on, who's the right person for that particular conversation?
Yeah. I mean, right now I've pretty much lost all interest in you, but I've still got time to go.
I'm sorry, what were you saying? But that's another thing, listening.
Listening.
I mean, my
so
goodness,
important.
So many conversations. And you want to talk about an example of where I might occasionally screw up. It's somebody says something and I didn't pick up on it.
Mm-hmm.
Something unexpected, something that has turned the conversation in an unexpected direction. And you got to be willing to go there, but it starts by actually hearing them say it in the first place. Answering your own questions. This is another one that really has stuck in my mind. I want to be sure that, like, the way I think about it is this. Listeners are not tuning in to hear me.
Mm-hmm.
They are tuning in to learn more about the issues, the ideas, the people, the places that affect our lives here in Greater Houston. That's what the guests are there for.
Right.
I agree with
you on that.
And then that's also what the listeners themselves are there for in the calls and emails and feedback that they provide.
I've had agents look at my demo tape and say to me, but there's not enough of you on it. And I'm like, but that's not the point. For me, the point is to give my guests a platform where they will say things and share things we haven't heard before. My job is to get them there. My job's not to be the focus of it.
Here's some other creeping bad habits. Avoiding direct questions on sensitive subjects. It's very easy if you have a particularly tough subject to try and walk your way around a question because you don't want to offend anybody. Look, the guest is there to talk about whatever the subject is. Just ask. Now, you don't have to be a jerk about it.
Okay.
You want to be diplomatic and kind, but being direct actually will help them.
I also think part of it is in preparing them, letting them know why they're there and what they're there to talk about, as opposed to bring them. I'm not a big fan of the ambush interview. so they're not caught off guard when the interview goes to X, Y, and Z.
I'm going to share one more tip with you that I am sure you're not going to see coming. Wear comfortable shoes.
Okay. All right. Explain that one to me.
Okay. So I once worked with someone for someone who ran this media organization, and I saw him walking down the hall one day wearing a three-piece suit and tennis shoes, and I asked him about it. And he says, every high-powered meeting I'm in, he says, I'm the most comfortable person in the room.
And I would agree with that, having never thought of it that way. But if anyone knew me, basically the way I come to work each day is one step above pajamas. So I really have never.
Well, and that's the point. If you're at ease, the guest will be at ease and it'll be an easier conversation.
When we did the first few seasons of interviews, I always wore a very similar outfit. And it was a black T-shirt, the jacket and pants, because I didn't want to. Everyone's like, why aren't you wearing a tie? This is formal. This is important. I was like, yeah, but if I come suited up, they have a different expectation. If I come in relaxed clothing, they will feel relaxed and they will understand the nature of the interview. And so I've always tried to mirror that back to
him. And these days, Ernie's just wearing a muumuu.
Yeah, I'm here on the radio. That's why I came to radio, so I can wear that muumuu. Craig Cohen, thank you so much. You can hear Craig every day right here at News 88.7 on Houston Matters at 9 a.m. live or 7 p.m. in a rebroadcast. If you are lucky enough to be listening to this as a podcast, you can get Houston Matters as a podcast wherever your favorite podcasts are available. Craig Cohen, thank you very much.
Ernie Manoos, you're welcome.
Still to come on Next Question, the hardest working man in show business, Jay Leno. The music of Morgan James, and a look at the films Aeronauts and The Two Popes. I'm Ernie Manoos, and you're listening to Next Question. Comedian and talk show host Jay Leno has been called the hardest working man in show business. At the height of his Tonight Show career, he continued to work club dates every weekend, banking his TV money and living off his stand-up salary. Recently, Jay Leno brought his stand-up show to Houston, and before he got here, we were able to get him on the phone and chat about his career, comedy, and his other passion, cars and motorcycles. Here's some of that conversation. So if people are fortunate enough to come and see you in concert, what are they going to be seeing?
Well, hopefully they'll see some funny stand-up. There's a lot of talk about contemporary things and about growing up and my parents. And we try to have a joke every 6 to 9 seconds, so we keep it moving pretty quickly.
Do you really calculate it that precisely?
Oh, yeah. You have to, because it's, you know, the thing I like about it is it's the most basic form of communication. With the exception of the microphone, it's something you could have done 1,000 years ago, mm-hmm. standing in a square or standing in a Roman Colosseum or a Roman hall and just talking,
yeah.
You know, and that's all you're doing. It's humans communicating one-on-one. And I find it's sort of interesting for a lot of millennials and stuff who are just used to communicating through text and iPhone to be in a room that's filled with laughter is a rather infectious experience. You know, I always meet people who say, oh, I watched so-and-so's comedy special. I didn't think it was very funny. I said, where did you watch it? On my iPhone. Well, you know, watching a comedy special on your iPhone by yourself, it's not the same as being in a room with other people who are laughing and enjoying something, you know? I mean, it really is. Humor is, for the most part, a shared experience. And the more people that share it, the funnier it seems to be. I mean, why is it when you go to see a comedy film, it seems so much funnier in the movie theater than when you watch the same movie at home, you know?
Yeah. One other obsession of yours is cars.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about Jay Leno's garage.
Cars and motorcycles. Yeah, I like working with my hands. You know, I'm one of those people who believes the heart is happiest when the head and the hands work together, if that makes any sense.
Uh-huh.
And when you work all day and you take a transmission out, you realize, oh, some guy got $80 for this. It makes you appreciate how easy it is to make a living telling jokes, you know? I mean, it does. I mean, yeah. I meet so many entitled people in show business who are mad because they're only getting paid $10,000 a night for whatever. And I go, guys, you're just talking, okay?
Yeah.
You're not physically wrecking your body. You're not lifting huge amounts of weight. You're not doing roofing. You know, you're just standing on stage talking. You know, it's a privilege. It's an honor, you know. And when you work with your hands, you do tend to appreciate it, being able to talk for a living.
Yeah. And how did that manifest itself into cars and motorcycles, though, for you, besides seeing the work there? But you could have been washing machines you were in love with. What is it about the vehicles that give you speed?
Well, I think it's sort of kinetic artwork. I mean, imagine a painting that you could actually get inside of, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what a lot of cars are, and it's a visually stunning thing that actually moves and can take you somewhere. So, I mean, that's kind of cool. I find that part of it fascinating.
Is there something on your wish list you want to get your hands on that you haven't quite yet?
No, because I usually buy the story more than I buy the car.
Huh?
A lot of times, I mean, I'll tell you a story. A lot of times, you know, I have a 51 Hudson Hornet, which is an American car from 1951, obviously. And I restored it, and I drive it around. And this old lady called me up one day. She's 96. And she says, I got a 53 Hornet. And she had a 51. I said, I already have a Hudson Hornet. She goes, mine's a four-door. So I like the two-door. Well, would you come look at mine? My husband and I bought it new. We bought it new in 51 in New Jersey. We drove it across the country with our kids to California to start a new life. Okay, so I go over to look at it. And he died in 96. And this is about 2004 or 5.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got four flat tires, and it hasn't run in 20 years. And she said, would you give me $5,000 for it? And I thought, well, okay. So I bought it, and I bring it back, and we start restoring it. It takes about 2 years to restore. So I figure, well, let me call the old lady up, and she's still around. So she's still around. She was 94 originally. Now she's 96.
Wow.
And she says to me, what does it look like? It all looks brand new. So I said, you want me to come take you for a ride? She goes, I'd love to go for a ride. Can I call the kids? And I said, well, sure. Well, the kids turned out to be 72 and 74. Okay. So I drive out to the house, and this lady at 96 years old, no hearing aid, no glasses, and the kids have got her blindfolded, standing in the driveway. She's had her hair done for this and all this kind of stuff, you know. So the three of them are standing there. I pull in, and she's touching the car, and I go, okay, take the blindfold off. And she sees the car, all the chrome's been done, and it's back to bright yellow, and oh, the tears are streaming. Can we go for a ride? Okay. So I got the two kids in the back, the 72-year-old and the 74-year-old, and she's in the front. She's talking away. And as we're driving, the two kids start poking each other, you know? And she just turns around, I told you to, and she's just slapping the crap out of them, just whacking them in the head. And the three of them are laughing so hard. They're just laughing so hard. She's, I told you to, kids, you can't sit still in the back seat. We'll turn this car around. She just, every cliche, she's just whacking them. And the three of them are having the time of their life, you know.
Yeah.
And the kids are telling me when they were teenagers, they were so ashamed that their dad in the 60s drove a 1951 car that the kids would have the dad drop them off two blocks from the high school, and they'd walk the rest of the way so nobody would see them, you know.
Yeah.
And when, you know, it was just fascinating, you know. And she finally died a couple of years ago at 104 years old. And it was just a great story.
Yeah.
You know, it was just a fun story. It was the only car the family ever had. You know, the two kids grew up with the car, and they were, first they thought the car was cool, then they were embarrassed by their dad to have this car, and then they realized it's a classic, and then they wanted to go to somebody who would fix it up and restore it. And to me, that's just what makes it fun, you know, just to see this 96-year-old lady whacking these two kids in the head. I mean, it was like the funniest thing you ever saw. It was hilarious.
I'm guessing when you go in your garage or your warehouse where these cars are kept, every one of them then has a story like that for you.
Well, that's what I mean. Everyone does have a story, you know, and it's usually pretty interesting. You know, a lot of times I'll buy a car from someone who just wants it to go to a good home.
Yeah.
And that's their primary concern, you know.
Yeah.
And it just makes for an interesting tale.
Mr. Leno, thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Talk to you later.
You can hear my full interview with Jay Leno on our website, houstonpublicmedia.org/next-question. I'm Ernie Manous, and this is Next Question. There's always a lot to see at the local cinemas or streaming online, so each week we invite our film critic, Dustin Chase, in to share his views on the latest offerings. Hello there, Dustin.
Hello, it's nice to be back.
I'll also let you know, Troy Schultz is here with us, who usually comes in a little bit later, but we dragged you in a little early today.
That's right.
How are you? So you're here, too. He usually brings us our music from Skyline Sessions, but we're all in here together to wrap up this show together. But, Dustin, this is your time. So, we're out in the theaters. I think the most interesting thing about what you're going to talk about today is two different films. We call them films, but they're both produced by streaming services. The world is changing.
They are. And I am going to surprise you and tell you something that I really loved.
You liked something?
I liked something. This might be my favorite movie of the year. I'm still trying to decide. But The Aeronauts, which is by Amazon. Now, this movie has had kind of a rocky ascension up to the sky. It was supposed to play in IMAX. They had to go back and edit it. It was supposed to open wide in release this weekend. They have since changed that. And I think what they're trying to get in the battle between Netflix and Disney Plus. So they're kind of saving The Aeronauts for a Prime release later
for
in
streaming
December.
Because they want to get people.
But look for it in theaters. It's a movie you really should see in theaters because it's Felicity Jones. It's Eddie Redmayne back together again. You know, they were in The Theory of Everything together. It's based on a true story, inspired by a true story about these two scientists and aeronauts who basically go higher up into the air than anyone has ever been in the hot air balloon, and they figure out how to predict weather.
Okay, I'm going to tell you, to me, sounds boring.
It's
but if you love
action-packed.
It, what happens?
It's
Why
action-packed.
Is it so good?
One of the things I love about this movie is that the moment it starts, they're jumping in the balloon. There's no buildup. They don't tell you who the characters are, and they use their time wisely because, you know, this is a 90-minute balloon ride, so they tell the backstory as they're ascending up into the air, so you don't get all that boring stuff in the beginning, and it's, you know, they're fighting weather, storms. It's really suspenseful. You'll be gripping your seat the whole time.
Troy, and ever flown anywhere in a balloon?
Never. I never will. Probably.
Not after either. Watching this movie.
But you loved it.
I really loved it. I've
Give
watched
it a, grade.
It a couple of It's an A minus.
Wow.
Yeah.
For those of you who don't regularly listen to us, that is quite impressive from this young man.
It's very good.
Okay, yet another one for us.
And of course, The Two Popes is now playing around in some limited cinemas, and it's going to be on Netflix as well. It's a very good movie, too. It's Anthony Hopkins and it's Jonathan Pryce. I think both of those guys are going to get Oscar nominations for this movie.
Are they playing popes?
They are playing popes. And it's another true story. I think this one is a really surprising one, how funny it is. It's very well written.
Give us a little background. The story is.
So it's about the first time that a pope has stepped down, I believe, in like 100 years or something. So he resigns, and so there's two popes at the same time, which, of course, you know, they're never.
Never happens.
Yeah. So it's about how one is changing reign over to the other, and they have very different views.
And you're probably too young, but Troy and I remember when this actually happened. Just a few years ago.
I think I was alive, yeah. So, but really, really good performances here. I think I think this is a movie that people are like, I don't want to watch that movie about the two popes. But I think if you watch it, you'll be really surprised at how engaging it is.
Did you watch the series back, and it's coming back, I guess, The New Pope?
I have not, no.
Okay, because I want to really get engaged
That's
in that.
That's the Jude Law thing, right?
Yes, yeah. And I have it, and I've watched it, but it doesn't. Have you seen it?
I have not seen it. I've been told that it's been recommended to me, though.
The two popes. One has already given me trouble. Two of them? But you like this?
I'll say this. You know how we were talking about last time about how the Mr. Rogers film, Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, wasn't really the inspirational movie I was hoping it was going to be? This one is. This one actually became the more inspiring go out and do good in the world movie over for me.
Yeah. So, grade?
This one's a B+.
Wow, you enjoyed your week.
I really did, yeah.
Okay, but now we know the weather is kind of getting colder out here down in Houston, so it must be award season.
It is award season. And some
it's kicking off.
Yes, so the National Board of Review, they have already announced their awards, and they went with your movie that you've been touting.
I wouldn't say I'm touting it, but
I
like
the one that we argue
about,
we'll say.
The Irishman.
Yes, they picked The Irishman, and then the New York Film Critics Circle, which is kind of a group of odd, weird critics that they get together and they don't vote.
Aren't all critics odd?
Well, I guess so. Okay. But these guys, they sit in a room and they debate the winners. So they
Yeah,
they sit around and choose their winners. So
and they chose.
They also went with The Irishman, but they had some weird choices there. They picked the Safdie brothers, who directed the Adam Sandler film, as best director, and they also gave Adam Sandler Best Actor.
It was interesting. Yeah, I saw that. Yeah. Yeah. Uncut Gems. It makes me interested to see that movie.
No, I was not a fan of that one. But
you didn't like it?
No, I'm in the minority on that one, too. They did go with Joe Pesci on Supporting Actor, though.
They did?
They did, yeah.
I'm right there. Yeah. I should be a critic.
Yeah, you should.
What are you looking forward to that's coming out this weekend? If we're going to spend our money somewhere, where are we going to spend
Well,
it?
If you can find The Aeronauts, that's the experience. And, you know, there's all these long movies like The Irishman, which was like, what, 3.5 hours long? The Aeronauts is only about 90 minutes. You can get in and out. You get your thrills really quickly.
For folks who actually want to see The Irishman, there's a meme going around that tells you how to watch it in 4 episodes. Right. Each at about 45 minutes, they tell you what time to start it and stop it. Yeah. If I can find the meme, I'll put it on our webpage for this at houstonpublicmedia.org/next-question. Easy to remember. You can find us there. You know what else you can find? You can find Dustin Chase over at texasartfilm.net, or you can follow him in the realm of social media at Texas Art Film.
That's it.
You like that?
Yeah.
Well, you know what that means? I'm done talking to you, which means it's at the end of the show. That brings us to another end. But before we let you go, Troy has been sitting here patiently waiting to share with us a little music. Hello, Troy.
Hey, Ernie.
How are things over in the world of Skyline Sessions?
They're really great. Yeah.
Keeping busy over
there? Keeping busy, yeah.
What have you brought us today?
So today is something that we recorded earlier this year. It's a performance by Morgan James. She's mostly known as a jazz singer. She started on Broadway in 2010 in a production of the Addams Family musical.
Really?
And she started performing in New York City clubs, and she started doing studio albums of covers. She's done whole full album covers of Jeff Buckley, Joni Mitchell, The Beatles. She even covered the entire album Black Messiah by D'Angelo, which was an interesting choice for her. But she came into the studio, actually not the studio, we recorded this on the roof of the station.
Hence Skyline Sessions. Yeah. You can see the skyline from our roof.
And it's a cover of the Beatles classic Dear Prudence.
Okay, so when doing a cover for you, what makes a cover work?
If it's done in a unique way, something that's not a copy of the original, and I think that that she succeeds in this particular performance. It was done with her husband, Doug Womble, playing guitar.
Dustin, any favorite covers of somebody doing somebody else's song you love?
Well, you know I'm not a big fan of remakes in the movie world.
Right, that's why I'm asking you. I like really bad remakes. Like, if it's really out of left field, I'm usually there for it. But this one isn't. This is a good remake, you're telling me.
It's not out there like, you know, a William Shatner cover or something like that.
See, those are the ones I like. But anyway, okay, well, if everyone hold tight for a minute, we'll play Morgan James doing Dear Prudence, that Beatles cover, in just a second. But before we go, a big thanks to our engineer, Tom Carter, who puts this show together every week for us. And I'm Ernie Manous, your host and producer. Remember, you can find us at our website, houstonpublicmedia.org/next-question. You can join us in the realm of social media at #NextQHOU, and you can find the podcast of this show available wherever podcasts are available. So until next time, and we're ready with our next question, we leave you now with Morgan James and Dear Prudence.
Won't you come out to play? Dear Prudence, greet the brand new day. The sun is up, the sky is blue, it's beautiful, and so are you, dear Prudence. Won't you come out to play? Dear Prudence, open up your eyes. Dear Prudence, see the sunny sky. Sing that you are part of everything, dear Prudence. Won't you open up your eyes? Look around, 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 around. Look around, 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 around. Look around. Dear Prudence, let me see you smile. Daisy chain, so let me see you smile again, dear Prudence. Won't you let me see you smile, dear Prudence? Won't you come out to play? Dear Prudence, won't you come?